that kind of reaction going on across the millions and millions of square miles of a planet, boy, that's a lot of opportunity. So we're going to find life. Is it going to happen in a year or 100 years? Is there anything left to discover? And how much of an investment do we have to make to find and confirm? But I can tell John has no doubt. I know I have no doubt. You're doubtful, Paul, as to when, but I don't think you have any doubt that we will eventually find life somewhere else, is my guess. Is that true, Paul? WS2N, K2LAW.
Oh, yeah. You could put me in the yes column, because you've got it's got to be 100 billion planets, and out of that, there's got to be a lot in that Goldilocks zone, and then another couple hundred billion galaxies thereafter. The numbers are too big. And that Miller experiment, was that Thorin? I think they called it Thorin. They eventually put methane or something in a test tube, gave it a spark, and wound up with amino acids. Is that the one you're talking about, Dick? Every time you bring that guy's name up, Miller.
Yeah, Harold Urey was the professor that was the mentor for Stanley Miller. 1956, he started off with a flask filled with water, carbon dioxide, oxygen, some methane, a bunch of seemingly inert materials that were known to exist on early Earth. Put that in a flask, essentially nothing happened. Passed a spark through it for a solid week, simulating lightning. And at the end of that week, they had this brown goo, primordial solution. And when you analyze that solution, of the 22 kinds of amino acids, 13 or 14 of them were already there. The basic building blocks of life were essentially there. So inert materials under a spark condition, like lightning, and you don't have to wait very long. 1 week will give you the amino acids. That was the Urey, Stanley Miller. Go ahead, John.
Dick, isn't it true that that same flask was examined a few years later when we were able to detect more of those items in that flask than he had discovered?
You got it. With the better detection techniques of downrange, I think they took the exact same raw materials that Stanley Miller had put on laboratory slides, microscope slides. He took the exact same material on those microscope slides and analyzed it with the better detection techniques, and they found a few more of the amino acids. I think there's 22, and I think they found 2, 3, or 4 more of them when they reanalyzed the exact same material. So it's a pretty strong chunk of evidence that life will form every time if you get the right conditions. WS2N, K2LAW.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I was wondering maybe it was an updated experiment, but it's apparently the same one I've read about years ago. But I didn't know they did a more modern test on it. That's good. Stardust, that went out to the comet Philp 2. That was the one that had this aerogel on it. It looked like the size of a tennis racket. And it went right past the comet. It got into the tail and had the, it opened up this tennis racket, collected a bunch of stuff, and to this day they're analyzing. I read about it not too long ago. To this day they have people, volunteers, analyzing like every molecule, millions of billions of, probably nanometers. There are crews of people on computers doing this and looking for different signs of like amino acids or whatever they're looking for. But that brought back some evidence. And, it had a tennis racket folded up, one inside of a took it back to the lab, and they've been analyzing it ever since. I think it's 12 years now, they've been analyzing it back to you there.
Yeah, one of those return missions, the parachute didn't open when it was supposed to land in Utah.
Yeah,
what was that again?
It was called Genesis. That didn't work out too good, but they still saved some of the stuff on that one.
Yeah, it landed hard without the parachute, broke open the package, therefore a little bit of contamination from Earth could have taken place. But still, I think it did manage to collect materials that were interesting. Isn't that true, Ripple?
Yeah, I remember they did get some useful science out of that one. That was a different one. That didn't go to a comet. I think that was a nearby asteroid or something. But this other one did. Now, Japan has a launch coming up, I think that's next year. And they're going to go to an asteroid, and they want to land on it and have a sample return mission. They've tried this before, and they got very little out of it. But it didn't work out as they planned. This is an upgraded one. It was called the Hayabusa. So I guess it's going to be like Hayabusa 2. Back to you.
Now, there's a couple of nice reports being published this week about the spacecraft that's now in orbit around an asteroid, and it's about to land on that asteroid, or at least a portion of a lander is going to go down, drill itself into the soil, put down a seismometer, and I don't think any of that gets returned, but is any of the material that it's going to be coming in contact with on that asteroid, is that going to be analyzed in any way, Paul? Go ahead.
They have 10 instruments on Philippe, and yeah, that's going to separate and land in November. Looking forward to that. And that's a comet. That's a 67P, and it's got two long names. You know, they always name these things after the people that discovered it, and I don't know what country they were from, but I can't pronounce their names. Two extremely long names, but thank goodness it's also called 67P. And it's a comet. And they'll land in November before it starts really off-gassing. It's got these little spears that are going to dig into the soil and then pull itself down. And then each leg has big, like, turnbuckles, I'm going to call them bolts, but they're very wide thread on these bolts, and they're going to, it's going to, like, screw itself into the comet. And NASA has a couple of investigating pieces of equipment on that, and it'll transmit its information back to Rosetta. Rosetta is like the mother craft following behind, actually in orbit around this comet, and this will do that for probably the next year as it goes around the sun and goes all the way out to all the way out to Jupiter before the official mission is over. You never know, it comes back every 6 years. It's a short orbit, short duration comet. Back to you there.
Yeah, those things that it's going to auger down into the comet, I would call them Earth screw anchors. The tower you're listening to right now, the guy wires are attached to Earth screw anchors made by the AP Chance Company. And probably installed, those things do a beautiful job. I did want to mention the fact that I encountered an event a couple of weeks ago. I was at a tower installation where a new antenna and a new cable was being installed. And the cable that was being installed was a cable that had been around for a while. It was a piece of Andrew Heliac 7/8 inch, where Andrew had installed the connectors. And the people doing the installation have had a lot of experience installing cables on cell towers. So these people, and I was watching them do the operation, were using a Inritsu SiteMaster, it's called, which really is, let me drop it. It's a fancy vector network analyzer with a couple of other fancy computer programs on board so that it's capable of measuring in a time domain manner. In other words, it has something that's called the Steinhelfer technique built into it, where it could really do a very high resolution emulation of a time domain reflectometry measurement of the piece of cable. So by doing the measurement on the cable, the guy doing the measurement said, the input connector is beautiful, the cable is beautiful, but that output connector is terrible. It's bad. You got to replace that output connector. I said, really? I said, measure it from the other end. He put the instrumentation on the other end. He says, yeah, it's still a bad connector. I couldn't believe that. The cable looks so beautiful. Connector's installed by Andrew. The cable had never been on a tower. It had only been stored in a dry basement for a couple of years. It was about to be installed on this tower. He says, you got to replace that connector. I put a 50-ohm termination on the end of the cable, and I measured it with an ohmmeter, and I measured 50.1 ohms. I measured with and without the termination. I measured an open circuit of infinity. I measured center conductor, a fraction of an ohm, outer conductor, a fraction of an ohm between the ends of the cable. Everything I could test with an ohmmeter looked to me like the cable was perfect. And he's saying the connector is bad. I said, how can that connector be bad? He's got to replace the connector. I said, really? I finally decided to say, okay, you say the connector is bad. Does it have a direct short circuit, center conductor to ground? My ohmmeter doesn't show it. Does it have a direct open circuit somewhere? My ohmmeter doesn't show it. Let me drop. So everything I can do as a simple go-no-go test tells me that is a beautiful piece of cable, and you say that connector is bad. How bad is it? Well, he said it's 32. I said, what does that mean? 32 decibels? He says, yeah. We won't install anything less than 35. I said, whoa. Where the hell did that number come from? Turns out that all the connectors that they install on all the cables that they install on cell towers have to meet the very strict requirement of passive intermodulation distortion from a pair of 40-watt CW signals. All intermodulation distortion products must be 150 decibels suppressed. 150 dBc from a pair of 40-watt signals is the requirement these days for essentially all cell sites. Let me drop. So he is saying that the cable can't possibly meet the PIM requirement unless the connector is good for at least 32 dB of S11, 32 dB a reverse voltage transfer ratio. In other words, you send the signal down to the component under test. In this cable, this case, it's a connector in the end of a cable, and the signal reflected back to you must be 32 dB down. That's about a 1.05 standing wave ratio. He's in other words saying anything above 1.05 is garbage and it's got to be replaced. Well, for a cell site, maybe. This was not a cell site installation. This is a two-way radio communication installation. Anything better than 2-to-1 would fly. Anything better than 1.5-to-1 is beautiful. And he's forcing everything to be 1.05. His requirements are extremely restrictive for that particular environment. I had heard the exact same guy. I'll get to you in a second, Wes. I heard the exact same guy on another piece of cable on another day say it's bad. And no one asked him how bad. His definition of anything less than 32 dB has got to be replaced. Otherwise, you're going to fail the PIM test. Amazing. Because a person is doing that day in and day out at cell sites, and he assumes that the cell site requirements must be met at all other two-way sites. Boy, did I have a conversation with him. It went on for a long time. N2XJN, K2RW, go ahead, Wes.
So in other words, what you're saying is that if you were just putting that on PNA, you wouldn't be able to see that.
That's not quite true. A real good modern-day vector network analyzer made by Inritsu, Hewlett-Packard, who else makes them? Those are the two big brand names. What was that again?
Advantest.
Avantech, yes. Avantech.
Advantest.
Avantest, Inritsu, Hewlett-Packard, and also the German company. Why can't I think of the name of that one? Rode Sports. Okay. Any of those brand names of vector network analyzers, properly calibrated, can measure approximately minus 50, minus 60, occasionally minus 70, but all of them can measure a minus 50 decibel reflection coefficient. So for him to measure minus 32, it's well within the range of where the instrument can show that. And he was using a calibrated termination, where the termination cost $5,000. And this was he had to adapt between it and the 716 connectors that are on it, 716 DIN connectors, which almost all cell sites are using exclusively for all of their cables that go outside of the building. So to measure minus 32, that's well within the range of a good vector network analyzer by those brand names that we just mentioned, Wes. N2XJN, K2RAW.
Interesting to know. I mean, it's very interesting. If you had a little time for my subject, I would appreciate it.
I must send a lot of cable back as detected.
I have the impression that one quarter or one third of all the connectors he measures every day he sends back. In the case of a cell site, that might be justified, because you fail that TIM test on a cell site unless you're very lucky with what particular frequency regions are being used between all of the brand names that are on that particular tower of that cell site. You fail that TIM test, and you're going to be dropping cell site calls. And if you drop enough calls, that particular brand name is going to be creating churn in that area. So cell sites have got an extremely tight requirement to meet. 150 decibels of rejection of intermodulation distortion products from tariff signals. Boy, it takes a lot of integrity of a connector to be able to pass that. Who's asking a question?
I was asking, Dick, do you think it was the installation that was the failure, or the product? That sounds so unusual.
In order for a connector on the end of a piece of angiohelix to meet that requirement, you've got to install that connector with a whole lot of tender loving care. You've got to make sure that you've cut the end of the cable, the insulation, the outer jacket, the inner jacket. You've cut them very carefully with just the right tools. Then when you put the connector on, you've got to do a real good job with installing the rubber gaskets to make sure it doesn't leak downrange. But the way you flare the outer conductor, the outer copper conductor of the coaxial cable, the way you flare that into the connector has to be done in an extremely smooth, continuous manner. No bumps, no nicks, or whatever. So that when the connector is put together, when the collet mechanism of the connector, when the two jaws come together of the connector, it's got to squeeze down on every millimeter of the perimeter of that flared outer conductor. That's got to be completely grabbed all the way around, 360 degrees. No air gaps anywhere. No copper oxide anywhere. Clean connector with no tarnish on the connector. And the same kind of quality has got to be done on the center conductor. When you do all that correctly, and it's going to take you a half hour to install that connector, you can pass that requirement. You cut corners anywhere on the installation of that connector on the end of that hard line, you will fail that test. And if you fail that 32 dB of S11 test, voltage reflection coefficient of, call it standing wave ratio, of the connector, call it a 1.05 standing wave ratio. I don't know the exact number, maybe it's 1.03, but it's something in that neighborhood. You fail that requirement on the connector, most likely you will also fail the PIM test. Because that PIM test, you could say it's looking for the tiniest amount of tarnish anywhere, of improper contact on all 360 degrees around the perimeter of that connector on all mating surfaces. If you don't have intimate contact all the way, if there's the slightest bit of copper oxide anywhere, the copper oxide will act like a local diode. It'll act like a rusty nail, so to speak, and it will be creating PIM. The only time that in the old days people ever ran into this, let me drop, was literally a rusty nail. If you had a two-way station master-like antenna installed on the side of a tower, and the station master is, let me pick a number, 3.5 feet away from the tower, and if those two legs of the tower where they come together have a rusty bolt, and RF energy is hitting that rusty bolt, you will make intermodulation distortion. In the case of NASA, they call it intrinsic negative intrinsic. In other words, all the individual metal panels of the Goldstone dish, the 260 foot diameter parabolic dish at Goldstone, California, that's part of the Deep Space Network. During the time that they were talking to the Apollo astronauts, they were transmitting an upward 10 kilowatts of uplink signal at 2.1 gigs and listening simultaneously into the same dish of the downlink signal at 2287.5. So 2.1, you have 150 megs of separation, something like that, between the uplink signal and the downlink signal. And as the dish moved, in order to track the moon, in order to track the satellite going around the moon, Apollo 11, we'll say, you heard bursts of noise as the wind blew the dish, and as the dish moved in steps, the individual panels, the 1 meter square panels that are all riveted together, that's the reflecting surface of the dish, as those MIM junctions, metal intrinsic metal, it suddenly come back to me, as those MIM junctions rocked past each other, you heard bursts of noise, which was intermodulation distortion noise, because you're transmitting and receiving from the same antenna at the same instant. Let me drop it. It's a little bit similar to the scratches you get on a station master antenna, which has been waving in the wind for 10 years, and the individual solder joints between the individual elements of that collinear antenna inside the radome, the solder joint develops a little bit of a crack, and that crack becomes, as it becomes mechanically wiggled with the wind, it becomes a junction where it probably goes from 1 milliohm to 5 milliohms and back to 1 milliohm as you're wiggling that junction. And that modulation, that rusty nail-like modulation, makes bursts of noise. So on a windy day, a bad station master on your repeater installation, again, you're transmitting and receiving from the same antenna at the same time, because your receiver is capable of receiving a signal of, let me pick a number, minus 110 dBm. You're transmitting a signal of plus 50 dBm. So you've got 140 decibels of power spread between your transmit power and your receiver power going into the exact same antenna at the exact same instant. The tiniest modulation of the junction anywhere in that system will give you scratchy noise. So now you see the relationship between PIM and noise on NASA and noise on a repeater site that has a less than perfect antenna. I think that's what you were asking, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW.
Oh, absolutely. Okay, let me let it drop. Okay, in fact, I got a quick comment on an experiment I did this week, if you wish to hear it.
I'm waiting for my time, if you don't mind.
Okay, you two guys have a discussion with each other, because these are the kind of subjects you guys discuss. So Wes and John, you decide who goes next. Go ahead, you two.
Okay, let me see if I have it. All right, Dick, I just wanted you to know the UHF antenna, the 432 antenna that I bought from Simon, arrived. I assembled it. And my cable that I had made up by cable experts did marvelous work. I quickly put that together, pointed it up to the sky, and put it on my vector network analyzer. The rated frequency was dead on, center on that pattern. It was perfect. As I varied the frequency, it would drift slightly, but at the rated frequency, it was right on that 50 ohm spot. What a beautiful thing that was.
Now, of course, that antenna is going to be mounted 40 feet in the air. Is that true, John?
Yes, it will be eventually up at about 45 feet.
On top of the WGB tower that's about to be installed?
No, not yet. It'll be pipe mount, but it'll be up there.
Well done. And that's a 2 meter antenna, I take it. You need it, no matter how many 2 meter... 70 centimeters, okay. 70 centimeters and 2 meter antenna. No matter how many of them you've got, I can't even count the number I've got, but it's never enough. You always need more of it, isn't that true, John?
Yeah. More is better. Whatever. Very good. Okay, go over to Wesley and see what he's doing. I have no idea.
Yeah, Wes, we'll discuss anything except nuclear experiments, molecules that are becoming ionized. I'm having some fun with Wes. And 2XJN, KTRI, to be glad, Wes.
Yeah, that was a good one. I'm trying to cover the subject because of the respect that I have for Roy, who is contributing a lot. Now, we had recently a series of emails because of the NASA video, and that NASA video was showing a spacecraft that was the Fermi Gamma Ray Space Telescope, and there was a revelation that this telescope was hit by the bunch of positrons, which are actually antiparticles. So then I was trying to postulate what possibly happened, and Roy was responding to that. I'm going to try to keep it as quick and possible and as easy to understand. The information from video was that during the lightning, there was a number of electrons that were created. They were going up to the atmosphere. They hit air molecules, and they create gamma rays. And then those gamma rays travel, hit another particles of air, creating pair, which is matter and antimatter, which would be positron and electron. And here's where the whole problem started, because I had a different explanation to that. So Roy was trying to rather tilt to the particle reaction basis that has a basis on conservation law base, so that the reaction takes place because of the conservation law base. And I had a problem with the fact that the NASA video is completely misleading. There is no such thing as the bunch of the antiparticles that are hitting they call it beam, which I would rather say it's a cloud hitting the detector of the satellite that is quite a distance. You know, gamma rays and beta particles. The electron positron is an antipair, but positron is a mass-containing particle. By that time, it is in a beta particle, positive beta particle, antiparticle, and cannot obey the same properties as the gamma ray, which is the photon.
Dick, I believe he's talking about black lightning or dark lightning, just to fill you in.
Actually, I'm trying to avoid that because they were trying to postulate that the black lightning, which me and Roy agreed that yes, they've got a signal, they interpret the signal, and that's only theory. So, for us to fully understand what is the antimatter, is the particle, is the material composed of antiparticles which have the same mass as the particles of ordinary matter but has the opposite charge and other particles properties. So then another sort of disagreement we had is that I said, well, yes, we could call positron antiparticle, but although it's correct, it's not precise, because we could have as well a antiproton. So when we're talking about antimatter, that is more wide description than that's what I was trying to relate to.
Are you familiar with the Alpha Magnetic Spectrometer, the one that was installed on the International Space Station about a year and a half ago, as I remember? It is detecting a significant number of positrons, it's measuring a significant amount of antimatter in the gamma rays or the cosmic rays that are hitting that thing right now. And so it is seeing some very high level, energy level particles, and it is seeing a higher percentage of antimatter than most people predicted. So in the when it comes to the cosmic rays coming into our solar system from the outer reaches of this galaxy, there is a fair amount of antiparticles bombarding us, is what the Alpha Magnetic Spectrometer is saying, from what I remember. And so if you Google Alpha Magnetic Spectrometer, if you Google the
bananas, it's a quite different animal. You think about Alpha Magnetic Spectrometer from International Space Station that was launched May 19, 2011. I'm talking about the satellite, a Fermi lab satellite that is equipped with number of detectors, and that thing is was launched in 2008, if I remember correctly. That was June 11, 2008. It was Fermi spacecraft that was named Fermi Large Area Telescope. Although they've changed the name in that to Fermi Gamma Ray Space Telescope. That one had nothing to do with the positron, and that's the detection. It did contain a set of detectors, but one was belonging to LAT, L-A-T, which is Large Area Telescope, and actually that was based on sodium iodide with thallium doping detectors, and the other one was the detectors GBM. Yeah, that was GBM, GBO actually. So the sodium iodide detectors were quite good. This is a very much known technique, but the BGO detectors cover energy from somewhere 150 kilo-electron volts to 30 mega-electron volts. And then I said that actually BGO is bismuth germanite. That is impossible for that particular satellite to be able to reach positrons at all. But I postulated different way to understand that. Since we established that, or I found the accurate information about that particular satellite, I was trying to postulate that we are rather dealing with the gammas that now are being recognized as byproduct of something. But for me, postulate that we have electron that hits air particle, create gamma. Gamma hits another air particle and create pair, matter and antimatter, and then eventually that antimatter hits the detector is out of reach. Although I see the explanation that Roy sent me, Roy wasn't aware of the fact what that particle was satellite was able to reach. I have a limited time, so I'm gonna go further with it. I'm sorry, guys. So practically, when we're dealing with the beta particles, they're like electrons, only they have a different charge. And the thing that that is happening is that when we have a beta decay that could be pretty much alike alpha, like a positron emission, the only thing is that positron emission has a very much specific properties and cannot be misleaded, which means that a positron, when is ejected from the nucleus, it originated from the nucleus. It must originate from nucleus in order to be the antiparticle of the electron. And then when it goes out, it collides with the electron that is on the orbit. Those two particles destroy themselves, creating 180 degrees, very much powerful photons, two photons. One goes one way, one goes the other way. Now, you need to have a orientation of that particular photon that must go exactly to the detector on the satellite that is able to read it. So, yes, they might be satellite was able to read gammas and eventually interpret those gammas, but I don't believe that directly 300 kilometers or whatever is the distance between a upper atmosphere with little of left air molecules where the dark light is present eventually as a theory, and go and hit a detector. So it's unlikely. Most of that energy will be destroyed. So that was what I was postulating. And to exchange.
What is the question?
Well, John, it's not a question. It's just me trying to respond to Roy's email. What he says is high energy free electron strike and atom electron cloud. High energy gamma photons are created by the force of the collision, which would be kinetic energy that is converted to electromagnetic energy. And very high energy photons can spontaneously be converted into matter antimatter pairs, which are separated by the Earth magnetic field. The new high energy free electrons collide with each other with other electron shells, and the process repeats. So I'm in agreement with what Ray say. I'm only having a problem with that they're able to see positrons and to exchange.
Okay, Dick, over to you, sir.
Yeah, I'm a bit behind on this one. I know that a significant number of emails have flown back and forth between Roy and you two guys, and I haven't had a chance to dig into them. I've been involved in two other projects this week that kept me very busy, and for one more week I'm going to be kind of busy. So I'm a bit behind on this one. I have the impression, though, that there's a disagreement among you guys as to what the satellite is detecting, what the dark lightning consists of, what particles are coming in from outer space, what reaction they're having. If I pass it over to you, John, and you try to put it into a simple set of words, I sense that there is at least a pair of interpretations. And so what are those interpretations, and where is the difference of opinion? KC2WGB, KQRIW.
Yes, Dick, I've been reading some of the emails going back and forth that Roy is kind enough to send to me also. But that's so far out of my knowledge, I really don't have any idea. Wesley's claiming that it's impossible for the satellite to detect it because obviously he thinks it's too far and the dispersion is too great between the affected elements. So I'm not sure. Too bad Roy isn't on. He could probably explain it. Back to you, Dick.
Let me respond to that.
You and I have to visit Roy and give him a high antenna, John. Go ahead, Deb West.
And Kate also.
We all postulated that the distance between the lightning that is happening in our upper atmosphere and the satellite is too big for eventually, if there is any leftover cloud of positrons, if there is any, because they might inhalate themselves, and all you're dealing with is just the photons at most hit the detector. And the second thing is that the satellite was never able to read any positrons at all. We're not talking about the alpha particles detectors that is in space station. If there is any positron that this thing could ever be able to see, it is because it does have a LAT detector, which is large area detector, and it is inside of the detector. So the light detector's gamma rays, by they have a technique known as pair conversion. When gamma rays slant into the layer of tungsten in the detector, it creates an electron and positron pair. Those particles hit another deeper in the layer of tungsten, creating further particles and so on. So the direction of the incoming gamma ray is determined by tracking the direction of those cascading particles back to their source using high precision silicon detection. That there will be sodium iodide with tellurium. So a separate detector counts up the total energy of all of the particles created, and since the total energy of the particle created depends on the energy of original gamma ray, counting up the total energy, that's how they determine the energy of the gamma ray, and eventually they would be able to calculate the origin and eventually the number of positrons that get into a collision. But when they get into the collision, you're not even dealing with gamma ray any longer. See, I'm wrong. Because if you have a collision between positron and orbital electron, you have a powerful gamma. So those photons are in region of gamma. So, okay. So maybe the only way that they can able somehow to find out that it works from the collision is by calculating the frequencies of gamma and finding that it might be 511 kilo-electron volts. Now, what is interesting about 511 kilo-electron volts is anything you take that would be able to create positron and electron collision, any species, it will have 511 kilo-electron volts. So 511 kilo-electron volts gamma goes to the detector, gamma detector, on Fermi space station. It will be then calculated as a product or byproduct of the collision. But the only thing is that you're never going to be able to see two photons at the same time, because one goes one way and the other one goes exactly the opposite way. And now you need to have another coincidence. The orientation of the collision must be exactly shooting at the antenna of the detector of the satellite. If not, you're never gonna be seen. Positron emission tomography has a rotational detector, and those rotational detectors are such to see angle of incidence. If not, if you have them wrongly positioned, you're not going to be able to see them. You might see one, if you're lucky. Enter Exia.
Are you saying that you don't believe there are enough cosmic rays to create the coincidence that's required? Or are you saying they don't have enough energy? Which portion of the experiment do you object to most? Because one evidence I've got for me that works, when I look at a lightning bolt and I see those zigzags, and I know that each one of those individual zigzags in that microsecond was a separate cosmic ray going in that direction, creating that ionization for that particular chunk of the lightning bolt. That to me is pretty strong evidence that the total number of cosmic rays hitting the Earth at any instant is a very large number. And I know that that's small compared to the neutrinos that are hitting me right now. But the energy that they've got, obvious by what the alpha magnetic spectrometer is measuring, boy, some of them have got a huge amount of energy. So are you objecting to the event, or are you objecting to the probability of the event that's being observed of US KQLIW?
Well, I object to the whole video. The whole video is completely misleading. It's made for the general public. And it's even misleading the general public. What I say is that satellite could not be hit by a cloud, a they say not even clouds. They should. They say it's a beam of gamma that came from the lightning. I understand that there is enough of temperature in the lightning that it, because it's about five times of the temperature of the sun. It can create gamma rays, but then I have a big problem from gamma ray hitting a molecule of air and then creating pair, which would be positron neutron, positron electrons. And then I have a problem with them saying, okay, the positrons hit the detector. The detector has nothing to do with positrons. It will never be able to see it. That's the first thing. The second thing is, positron is the particle that has a mass. I don't see how come that cloud could be that such powerful, go such a distance, and eventually, because it goes everywhere, right? And then eventually hidden, being able to be seen by the detector. I also object the fact that they didn't strictly say, okay, we have a pair production, but not by gamma ray hitting a molecule of air. So what is missing in Roy's explanation is how exactly this process happened, how gamma can create a pair. Now that it's creating the pair, how is that happening? We know that, let's say, we deal with... hold on. Okay. So let's say we're dealing with a positron creation. One of the ways of doing it is, let's say, we have electron capture. Yeah, one of the electrons is swallowed by the nucleus. We might also say that when we have a cloud of electrons because of the lightning, that electrons shoot the nucleus. It might be true, might be not, because that was not explained by Roy. So let's say, okay, we have that. Then during this process, inner orbital electron disappears, one proton disappears, an additional electron appears in the nucleus. And then we have additional energy that is released from the nucleus in the form of several characteristic gamma photons. So I have no problem with that. So when nucleus capture an orbital electron, the vacancy is left in the orbital from this electron, so there is a hole, and the transition to another orbital electron fills the vacancy that results the transition. So we have a lot of X-rays. Now, I can understand that those X-rays are received by the detectors, because there are plenty of them, they are very much powerful. Whenever you have a reposition of electrons, you have X-rays. So, if we say that at first we have electrons hit the molecules of air, maybe those electrons are being able to hit the nucleus, doubtly, but that process wasn't explained to me, at least I don't know how is that possible to happen. But so I could say they can see electrons, but when we're talking about a positron, that few radionuclides that could produce this, that would be Na22, carbon 11, or fluorine 18, let's say, in the air, regular what we have in here. But if we try to follow what this positron emission is, that the process is similar to beta decay. So when positron emitting nuclei decays, one proton disappears, additional neutron appears in the nucleus, and at the same time, two particles, positron and neutrino, are ejected from the nucleus and escape from atom with high velocity. So this positron would be beta plus, has the same mass as a negatron, beta minus, and it has a positive charge equal to the magnitude of that of the negatron. And here we have that what I could see as possibly happening at the detector of
less than a minute.
Okay.
So in other words, we have a collision. The positron enters the positron encounters an electron, and two are completely destroyed, and they leave 511 kilo electron volts emitted precisely opposite direction, 180 degrees apart. Positron inhalation always release 511 kilo electron volts regardless of parent nuclei which the positron is emitted. The high energy gamma then comes from the photons, and those photons belongs to gamma, and that would.
Good night, John. T2RW to be clear.
Happy that
that it exists. That makes it much easier. You know, that must take some kind of active monitoring on somebody's part. Because I've heard a few times. Just kind of was hoping this guy would go away. At one point, we were doing the email looking for signal strength reports. I was wondering how that turned out.
They've received quite a bit of information, and they are tracking it down. There's also something else coming down the log, which I have been viewing that they've set up. So there are many efforts being made, but it seems like some of them are working.
That's just great. You know, I mean, I'm happy to hear that we're figuring out a method of getting a handle on this problem.
Yeah, I agree. You know, I'm not a people person. I don't understand why people do such really idiotic things. What they get out of it or how it satisfies them or whatever. But unfortunately, we do have to put up with it sometimes.
Yeah, I like to think about why people do things, but sometimes you just can't come up with an answer for it. And I certainly have no clue as to why this guy does that, but I don't know what he thinks he's getting out of it. He obviously requires some technical capability to do what he's been doing, so if you have that type of technical capability, get the license and make friends.
Well, as you know, in this hobby and this adventure that we're on, you can meet some wonderful people with great information. I mean, things, certain kind of stories and things that you'd never be privy to. That's interesting, but why they do that, I just, the rats running around in his brain must be really difficult to handle.
Yeah, very good, I like that. But you know, you're right, he's like listening to a guy like Dick. Where would any of us find someone like that, someone who's as smart as he is and has the experience that he's had? It's just unlikely to meet people like that, so why throw that opportunity away? Because, I mean, I think Dick is pretty interesting. There's other guys like him, guys like you and Wes. I mean, Wes has some really interesting ideas. Why make things difficult when you have such, people that have such a great amount of knowledge and experience that you can talk to?
Yeah, agree with you 100%. You can find people like Dick, but then also find someone like him who's willing to pass the information on. And that's basically what the learning experience requires of the person who gets the knowledge. The idea is to pass it on and to have somebody interrupt the flow of data. All right, if you don't like, don't listen. But to interrupt it and to cause other people to have difficulty learning or understanding is just very unfortunate, in my opinion.
No, I agree with you 100%. In a way, it's a shame that we as human beings can't pass on the information that we've acquired in our lifetime. What Dick is doing with this TechNet is certainly a wonderful way to get around the limitations of, our own longevity, or lack thereof.
Yeah, absolutely true. Interesting people. You look at this repeater and some of the members, we have like Eric, Will McDonald, Dick, Glenn, so many people that come in, and you. I mean, I've learned an awful lot about the airline industry and some of your experiences. It's always a pleasure to hear from somebody who is in the particular trade that you're interested in or profession, and there's so much knowledge and so many things to learn. That's why I always make the statement that I'm a dummy. I look at what's available to learn and what I actually know. It's nothing.
I agree. I mean, I think I know some things, but there's so many other guys out here that know other things, and that it's a pleasure for me to learn from them. And, I've listened to you and Wes. Quite frankly, I don't understand a lot of what Wes says, but it's because he's talking about a field that I don't have much experience in, or any experience in. But it's still fascinating to listen to him when he starts off on one of his subatomic descriptions of how things work.
Yep, the functioning of atomic particles is always interesting, and my experience with that is antique. There's a lot of new